However, back to Western Buddhists and the four main Eastern Buddhisms. These four Eastern Buddhisms are differentiated from one another mainly in two ways. First of all, according to the school of Buddhism, that is to say, the doctrinal school of Buddhism to which they belong. And secondly, according to the culture, the regional culture, even national culture, with which they're associated. And the second of these is probably the more important, at least from a practical point of view. So what Western Buddhists actually encounter in practice is not Buddhism. In fact, we could say that many Western Buddhists never encounter Buddhism at all. What they in fact encounter is a particular school or sub-school of Buddhism associated with a particular national or regional culture. For instance, the Theravada, which is associated with Southeast Asian, specifically Sinhalese culture. This is what we experience, this is what we encounter. Or Zen, associated with Japanese culture, and so on. Actually, the situation is even more complicated than that. So how is that? Well, Buddhism arose in India. India has got a very rich, a very powerful, a very ancient culture. So from the beginning, Buddhism, as soon as it emerged from the Buddha's mouth, so to speak, was associated with Indian culture, indeed with Indian cultures. Because in the course of the 1500 years that Buddhism was alive in India, Indian culture went through several different phases of development, each with very strongly marked characteristics. So from the beginning, Buddhism was associated with Indian culture. And then Buddhism, as we say, went from India to China. But what actually happened? Did Buddhism, just Buddhism, go from India to China? What went from India to China was Buddhism plus Indian culture. And then in China, Buddhism assumed certain Chinese characteristics, culturally speaking. And then, of course, Buddhism went to Japan. But again, what was it that actually happened? What went from China to Japan was Buddhism plus Indian culture plus Chinese culture. And in Japan, Buddhism assumed certain Japanese cultural characteristics. So today, Japanese Buddhism consists of Buddhism plus Indian culture, plus Chinese culture, plus Japanese culture, and it is this Buddhism, inverted commas, which goes, as we say, to the United States of America, or Britain, or even New Zealand. And sometimes the Buddhism succeeds in penetrating all these layers of culture, which are superimposed upon it. Sometimes it does not. Sometimes it does not. So what is the position? What is one to do? What does the Western Buddhist have to do when confronted by these different Eastern Buddhisms? Well, the first thing that he has to do is to learn to distinguish what is really Buddhism from what is Southeast Asian or Chinese or Japanese or Tibetan or even Indian culture. Not that there's anything wrong with any of those cultures. They're often very beautiful. Very beautiful indeed, but they're not the same thing as Buddhism, not the same thing as the Dharma. So that when we say that the FWBO is a Buddhist spiritual movement, we do not mean that we've adopted some particular form of Eastern culture. Though, at the same time, this does not necessarily mean that we reject Eastern Buddhist culture. Some of that culture does express the spirit of Buddhism. Take, for instance, the Japanese art, the very beautiful, the very inspiring art of flower arrangement. This surely expresses something of the spirit of Buddhism. And in the FWBO, we're very happy to adopt this kind of Eastern culture. But we adopt it because it is Buddhist, because it helps us in our spiritual development, not just because it's Eastern, not just because it's Japanese. Some Western Buddhists, unfortunately, are unable to make this distinction between Buddhism and Eastern culture. They think that they're attracted, in some cases, by Buddhism. But in reality, they're attracted not by Buddhism. They're attracted to an exotic, oriental culture. Sometimes they think that they're trying to be Buddhists. But in reality, they're just trying to be, which means to copy, Indians or Japanese or Tibetans, or at least to look like them. This is quite harmless, of course. There's no harm in dressing up as an Indian or pretending to be a Japanese or imagining that you're a Tibetan. It's quite harmless, except to the extent that it represents an alienation from one's own culture. It has nothing to do with actually being a Buddhist in any real sense. But in some parts of the West, and certainly in England, and I suspect in the States, we have a very strange situation, because all four main Eastern Buddhisms have been introduced, and they all have Western followers. And all these followers are supposedly Buddhists, but they all follow different Eastern cultures. Southeast Asian, Japanese, Tibetan, as the case may be, so they're unable to live together. They're unable to practice Buddhism together, even though they're all Western Buddhists. And we had an example of this sort of thing in the FWO some years ago, not very long after we'd started. Not far from London, there was a group of English Zen, Japanese Zen, Buddhists, and they wanted to join one of our FWO communities. So after quite a bit of discussion, we agreed, though personally I had my doubts and misgivings. But anyway, we thought we'll give it a try. So this group of English Zen Buddhists, I think there were four or five of them, they moved into our community. But almost at once a difficulty arose, because they refused to join in the puja, that is to say, the evening devotions. And why was this? Because our puja, our FWB puja, was in Pali and English, mostly in English. And their guru had told them, so they said, that they should do their puja only in Japanese. So while the other members of the community did their puja in English and Pali in the shrine, these English or Japanese Zen Buddhists, they all waited outside. They wouldn't even sit in the shrine and listen. And their guru, incidentally, was an English woman who'd spent some time in Japan. So this was the sort of situation that one had. I'll give you just another example connected with this same guru. Japanese culture is what sociologists call a shame culture. In Japanese culture, shame is used as a technique of social control. A Western Christian culture is probably a guilt culture. In Japan, that is to say, in traditional Japan, suppose a young person, and in Japan, in traditional Japan, one gathers a young person is very much a young person. Suppose a young person misbehaves. Suppose he's noisy or he slams the door. What happens? An older person will proceed to imitate him, greatly exaggerate him. If the young person has been noisy, the older person will be four or five times as noisy. If he slams a door, the older person will just go and slam it three or four times very, very loudly. So the young person then feels very ashamed. He realizes that he's being corrected in that way. He feels very ashamed, and he desists from that particular misbehavior. Now, this technique of control through shame was transferred to the Japanese Zen temple. If the disciple misbehaved, the master imitated. Supposing during the meditation the disciple slouched, well, the master, if he noticed, would immediately slouch right over. The disciple would notice, feel very ashamed, pull himself up straight, and in that way he'd learn. And this technique was called mirroring. I don't know if anyone's heard of it. It's very well known, very popular in Japanese Zen Buddhism. It's called mirroring. Okay? So the guru I'm talking about happened to pass through London some years ago, and it seems she didn't like very much what some of the English Buddhists, who hadn't been to Japan, poor creatures, were doing. So what did she do? She started mirroring them. She started mirroring them. But the English Buddhists, I mean, not being Japanese after all, they didn't understand what she was doing. Her head monk, who I believe was an American, who was accompanying her, he also started mirroring. I remember that he thought the English Buddhists on retreat ate far too much. So just to teach them a lesson, he started mirroring them. He took a second helping of everything just to show them how greedy they were. But what happened? The English Buddhists thought that the poor fellow must be hungry. So they gave him a third helping of everything. And the guru, I was told, was quite annoyed. She said the English Buddhists were very stupid. They couldn't appreciate her wonderful mirroring technique. But one might say, perhaps one shouldn't say, that she was the stupid one because she couldn't understand that mirroring was a part of Japanese culture. It had nothing to do with Buddhism, and it wasn't appropriate in the West. Anyway, there's no need to labour the point. It should be sufficiently clear by now.